You are listening to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and role-playing gamers.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.
Hello and welcome to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and the people who play them. My name is Ran Aviram.
And my name is Uri Lifshitz. Hello!
And today, in our 99th episode, we shall discuss running published adventures, otherwise known as modules. That is, adventures that were written by someone and then published to the public, usually under some sort of an existing system. There are many, many adventures for D&D 5, for example. And these can be either official, like an official adventure by Paizo or by Wizard of the Coast, or something that someone created themselves and then kickstarted, or maybe they made it available through DriveThruRPG or whatever. I love running published adventures. I love them. I don't remember when was the last time I ran an adventure I myself written, except for adventures that I've written to be published. And I needed to play tests and make sure that they work. For my own games, for my own party, I like the feeling of knowing that I don't need to do, you know, the big part of the work. I need to do some work, and that's what we'll be discussing here, what work needs to be done. But most of the work has been done by someone else who written down the adventure and thought about all of the encounters and the storyline and NPCs, etc. And, more importantly, they did a good job. I only run the best of adventures. Why would I ever run nothing but the best of adventures? There are so many of them. So I am making sure that in the very few fleeting moments when I get time to sit with my friends, we all enjoy a high-quality entertainment thanks to the good adventure that I chose for us. This is why running published adventures is the best.
Right. So, I'm not a big fan of running published adventure. I like it. It's awesome. There is an endless list of reasons why running published adventure is awesome. I don't like it, though. I like tailoring my adventure specifically to my players. I like to change things midway if I feel the need to. I like to work with my players to create the adventure and where it goes And as a general rule, I tend to lean toward collaborative storytelling, collaborative plot building, up to the point where in some of my campaigns, I start an adventure by saying, each player can describe one random NPC, and one of those four or five NPCs would be the villain of this campaign. Go. Having said all that, there are many advantages to running published adventures. There are some situations in which you would prefer a published adventure. If you don't have the time and effort to create a whole adventure from the ground up. Or if you want to run something in a convention. Or if you specifically want to run a specific adventure which was published and is very interesting. Or awesome, or you got amazing reviews on. So what we will discuss in this episode is how to make the most of that. You have decided to run a published adventure. How would one go about doing that? And do note that we are talking about published adventures, not published campaigns. There are some differences that we won't get into in this episode.
So let's start by picking the adventure. As I said, I run only the best of the best, but how do I know what is the best of the best? There are several things to be considered. First, what it is that you're looking for. For example, whenever my party sits down to decide on what we are now playing, the system is usually the most important thing that we need to decide on, and that already limits my options. If we decide we are running a Savage Worlds game, and let's say even in a specific setting of Savage Worlds, we already know everything about that, I will then go and I will pick from the list of those adventures that were created for this specific setting. So, genre and system are obviously the limiting factors. But beyond that, in order to know if something really fits you, it is vitally important to read reviews. First of all, it lets you know if this adventure was actually reviewed by anyone. If you look for a review of an adventure and barely any results come up, And if you ask around a bit, in our group or in others, anywhere around the internet, if anyone knows about this sort of adventure or any website that would review these sorts of adventures, like maybe there is somewhere in the internet a website that only reviews Savage World adventures, or maybe there's somewhere that only reviews D&D Adventure League adventures. And yes, there is one that only reviews Adventure League adventures. So if there is none of these, if you can't find even a single person, and you checked, but not a single person even bothered to write a review about this adventure, you probably shouldn't be the first one to check it out. Maybe I'm wrong, but again, I don't have all the time in the world. I want to run the best. So many people buy adventures from DriveThruRPG, if they like to run PDFs, of course. Because on DriveThruRPG, almost all of the adventures available there are only available as PDFs. I think it's really rare to find a published module that you can buy physically, specifically from DriveThruRPG. However, DriveThruRPG has a rating system, and you can read reviews on the website. And I think you, most of the time, that's quite useful, especially if you read the non-5-star reviews. You are not looking for expert opinion on how great this adventure is. You're looking to see what's wrong with it. You're looking to see what won't work with this adventure if you try to run it. For example, maybe an adventure have 15 reviews and like all of them are 5 stars, but 2 of them are 3 stars. This is probably a great adventure. Let's read the 2 3-star reviews to see what they didn't like. Maybe the cartography isn't great and the maps are problematic. Well, okay, maybe I can fix that if I'm good with maps. Maybe the story wasn't coherent. And it was actually a great set of encounters, but there wasn't much actually connecting them. Ah, well, that I cannot fix. I don't want to fix that. As myself, Eran, as a GM, I'm looking for an adventure that already provides me with a story. That's the main thing I want to avoid creating myself. So even if it's the best adventure because it has the amazing encounter and everyone loved it, if it does not do what I'm looking for, this is not the greatest adventure for me. So reading about adventures is really important here.
I want to put an extra emphasis on what Eran just said. We tend to think about ratings, and ratings are usually 1 to 5 stars, and that's it. And most adventures are really good at some things and not as good in others. And it is crucial that you will understand what this specific adventure offers and what it doesn't.
Yes.
This could be by design, or the result of neglect, or maybe the author did not want to create an adventure which is interesting mechanic-wise. Maybe they just wanted to tell a great story and all the monsters are basic skeletons and trolls. Mm. And this may be a real bummer for you if you really love the system and see how it uses the mechanic in different and interesting ways. Or if you're in it just for the story, this would be an amazing adventure for you. So take the time to understand, what is it you want, and could that specific adventure give that to you?
Some places where you can read reviews is, of course, DriveThruRPG itself, as we said. RPG.net have a lot of reviews. Ian Wald does some reviews. And again, according to the specific system that you're using, it could be that someone out there somewhere has created a website where they review adventures. Beyond that, asking around is a great way to do so. People that have ran the adventure and can recommend it should then be asked a follow-up question: what did you like best about it? What was it lacking? Because that will help you decide if this adventure is really for you. A friend telling you, this adventure was great, I had a lot of fun with it, is not useful. It's only the start of the process. You should really continue to the next part to see if this adventure is for you and not only for them.
And as always, Google's your friend.
The next part is this. After you decide which adventure you want, you now need to read the adventure. You need to get to know it. And that means, first of all, yeah, read the whole thing. Just go through the entire thing. So it will be somewhere in the back of your mind. For example, later on, whenever they mention the troll, you will generally know what they're talking about, and you will generally remember which part of the book it is in, so you will be able to navigate around and find it. Reading the whole thing is like looking at the map. It's really useful at the start.
And when Iran talks about the map, what I usually do after I read the whole thing, I look at the map and I try to envision going through it, and I also read the plot summary again and make sure that I know every twist, turn, and person noted in the plot summary. This is an excellent tool to make sure that you have actually got the adventure in your mind.
I like what you said about imagining stuff, because I think it really helps.
Oh, you like imagining stuff.
Yes, Uri, I enjoy it. Let's make a hobby out of it. Every adventure, every published adventure is designed for a generic group, because the writer, just because it is a public piece of content, the writer does not know who will play this. So they can only have some assumptions. Like, for example, if it's for D&D 5, you will probably have various classes and races in your group. That's a pretty safe assumption, but you can say very little beyond that. So for us, when we sit down and read it, it's really useful if we imagine ourselves inside the adventure. If we try to think about, okay, this room had 3 goblins and a fire pit, what will my group do here? And this is a question both for the players and their characters. You know what the characters can do. You know how your players tend to think. So if your party has, like, for example, a medallion of trap detection or something, and they always detect all of the traps, then when they enter this room, they will know exactly where the pit trap is, and the whole shtick of the room, of the goblins using the pit trap to navigate around it and so force their combatant to fall into it, it will not work. That might be fine. That would be cool, actually. It might be a lot of fun for your players to assault this room and the goblins think they can somehow trick your players, but they will not be able to do so because your players are so clever and good for them. Or maybe it will just make the whole thing into an annoying mess where we just rolled a few tech rolls, we hit some goblins, they hit us at the end, and it was actually, there was actually nothing interesting going on. It was a very basic combat encounter. It's up to you. You know best. Try to imagine what might happen, and then, if needed, maybe think about a change or two already, right now, that should be applied. But you will get to changes later on. We're still about getting to know the adventure. Or you have something called table reading here.
When you're about to act in a movie or in a stage production, there is something called a table reading. That is basically where all the cast is assembled and everyone have their own copy of the script. And you read the script sitting at the table in your character, but nothing beyond that. That's called a table read. It's basically designed so that everyone will be familiar with the work and with their own character and maybe try out a bit of voice acting and see how things work between characters. The main advantage here is that you can see how the dialogue works in the back and forth between the actual players and characters and actors. I do something similar when I'm about to run an adventure. I sit down, I read a description, I read the read aloud text aloud, and I imagine the influence that it would have on my specific players and their specific characters. And I try to envision what would be the back and forth. And I try to see how each encounter escalate or move forward. So I would have some image in my head to work with, as of course reality will deter from that. And I would recommend everyone to do a table read, to go over the whole thing and read aloud those parts that are meant to be read aloud. If there's an NPC and you're thinking how that NPC might sound when they talk with the player characters, speak their role out loud. Get to know the NPCs. For me at least, that's one of the best ways to get distinct NPCs.
I agree about the last part. I like to try out the voice as I read the NPC and I think about how to talk as the NPC. I would admit I almost never read the read aloud text before I run them. I just skip those. I use them and paraphrase them when I run the adventure, but not when I read it the first time. I don't know why. I find them boring. I mean, I don't need them. They are meant for the players, so I'll just read what happens in the encounter and continue on. All of that being said, before every session, it's really useful to sit down and read the parts that you are expecting to run this specific session, which will usually be an encounter or two. It really depends, of course, on the game, etc., etc. And it will be useful for you to estimate the time it will take you to run the adventure, or specifically this segment. Most of the adventures are already segmented, either by rooms or by parts or whatever. Do you think you will be able to get to the end of this segment by the end of tonight's session? Yes? Okay, then you should probably read all of it. Do you think you will only get about halfway? Okay, then read like halfway and maybe a bit more. It's better to be over-prepared by a room than under-prepared by a room. And also, I find it really useful to sometimes reread the adventure summary, the big picture. If I sort of forgotten what is actually going around and I got too invested in the specific things that are happening currently in the game, I might just completely forget about like the villain or the plans or things that should happen or specific themes I should try to integrate into the game. So in order for me to always think about the big picture, I sometimes find myself rereading the most basic descriptions of what's going on in the adventure or in this specific part. This is usually something for the more elaborate adventures or actual mini campaigns or campaigns, but still, for me at least, really useful. So we talked a bit about campaign. Let's talk about connecting this module to your campaign. We are assuming you are already playing some sort of a campaign and you want to run this specific module as part of it. So you want to find a way to augment the adventure in such a way that it will fit your setting, it will fit your, the style of your campaign, what's going on, the storylines of your campaign, and your specific party. The first step in this is to choose an adventure that is already fitting as many of those as possible, of course. And we talked about that before. So let's assume you have an adventure that is already, it's not out there. It's not about a pirate ship while you are actually playing in the jungles. It's about something in a jungle, and you are playing in a jungle with a group of explorers, jungle explorers specifically. So everything is sort of working. So the main things you should probably think about are the lead-in and the lead-out. That is, how both ends of this adventure connect to the rest of your campaign. Assuming that most of what happens inside the adventure can just be the adventure. Hopefully, of course, you will do as little work as possible because we wouldn't have bought a published adventure if we wanted to do all of the work ourselves.
Yeah, I can see it now, an adventure and you open it and it says, have them do amazing things. Victory should come at the end. That's it.
Many adventures have adventure hooks. They can be fine, but again, they cannot but ignore your party. It is highly advisable that you only do whatever is best for your party. So, even if one of the adventure hooks seems like kind of amazing and awesome, like your grandparent offers you a treasure map of an ancient island full of treasure, that's nice. But wouldn't it be like 10 times more interesting for the character if what pushes them toward the treasure island is their own personal story? They must have some hooks already. They're chasing someone. They're running away from someone. They want something somewhere. Okay, just point them at the start of this adventure. This could mean that you will need to change some things about the adventure itself. Like, for example, changing the MacGuffin. Uri, what is a MacGuffin?
MacGuffin is that special something that the plot revolves around, and it is usually not very important for the plot, except in terms of that is the thing that drives the plot forward. Consider the ring in Lord of the Rings.
Yes, the ring is an excellent MacGuffin, because it is very obvious how heavy the burden it is by having it also do some stuff. When you put it on, you become invisible, but you are also immediately exposed to Sauron. And I'm thinking of the movies, of course. The movies make it very clear how important the ring is, while actually it's just a small ring that doesn't do a lot during the entire game. You just need to get it somewhere and throw it somewhere. So a lot of adventures have some sort of MacGuffin, even if the MacGuffin is important, even if the MacGuffin does something, in many ways it is the thing that advances the plot and therefore can be augmented in some way. Maybe the MacGuffin is the prince that you need to escort somewhere. That's the person that enables the entire plot of the game. He's not really an ideal MacGuffin. He's a prince. He's an NPC. Maybe he's even useful in some cases. It doesn't matter for our current purposes. What we could do is also say, yes, and this prince knows a secret that your character really cares about. Or the marriage of this prince with whatever princess or prince that you need to escort them to is really important for the church that you are part of and want to become the head of or something. You can always take whatever it is that is important to the adventure and find a way to weave into it in an intrinsic nature some importance for the players and what they care about. But that's like the main things. You can also and should also connect the campaign and the adventure by combining the setting. Like, for example, if the adventure is about pyramids in the deep jungles filled with snake people, and your setting doesn't have snake people, you can do one of two things. You can say, okay, we do have snake people. They were always around. They are mostly around this pyramid. And now you've augmented your setting, and you should probably have some more snake people in the future as well, now that they are part of it. Otherwise, the adventure will always feel like it was not part of anything going on, like it was its own thing. And we try to avoid that feeling. The other thing you can do is say, ah, yes, they are all were-snakes. And we have were-creatures. These are specifically were-snakes. The party has already encountered werewolves and werebears, and they're actually a pretty big part of our setting. So it isn't unusual that we have a whole group of were-snakes. Oh, and the god they're worshipping? Actually, we will change it just a bit, and it will be the leader, the ancient leader of their sect, and they worship that leader like a god, but they are aware that she used to be like a mortal person, a were-snake herself. They gain their divine powers of the spells or whatever from the usual sources of my setting. I mean, they worship her as an aspect of the god of poison, which is a normal part of our setting, and we all know about the god of poison. And now everything is connected. And now our players, when they reach this temple, it's not completely out of nowhere. Maybe they need to research a bit. Maybe they need to understand how come there are snakes here and where do they come from. But it all makes sense in the grand scheme of things. Again, it's best if you avoid nitpicking stuff and instead focus on the big picture. Instead of asking where each of the priests get their powers, just change the name of the god or something like that. That would be the easiest way, and it also means that you will have less places where you can stumble, forget, or get confused. Last thing you might want to think about doing is connecting subplots and NPCs. Like, for example, switching between one of the funny, hilarious NPCs that is built into the adventure with a funny, hilarious NPC that the PCs already know. Or maybe you want to put some links to the Thieves Guild that the PCs have been chasing for I don't know how long, and they're always somewhere in the background, so you want to put some Thieves Guild influence into this adventure as well, even though it has nothing to do with thieves. That's fine. I would suggest to focus, like laser point focus, on the specific points. Again, you don't want to forget or get confused. So just say, ah, during the break-in scene, they see some remarks, some graffiti or something that makes them believe that the Thieves Guild have marked this place in the past. That might be enough. Or, ah, yes, I'll just take this goblin character and replace them with the hyena character. They love the hyena. It's awakened hyena. It's so funny. They love the awakened hyena. I'll just put the awakened hyena here. Why is he here? He was captured by the goblins. The end. And we can just continue on and improvise whatever is needed during the game itself.
And remember the simple trick of using R&R. Rename and reskin.
Very true. Avoid as much work as possible. There's still a lot of information here, especially if you need to change something. The main question is, how do you access this information? I would highly recommend using physical props. So first, walk beforehand if you can, to have everything already arranged the ways that you're used to. For example, I really like using a lot of post-it notes and bookmarks. I put post-it notes in the important parts of the book where I need to flip to. Like, for example, the map, if it's in an inconvenient place, I might put a bookmark there. And if there's a specific NPC or powers that I look for, then I might put a post-it there. And then I can switch between them during the game mid-flight. However, I should really put all of the bookmarks and post-it notes before the game, so I won't need to do it during it. Another thing that is really useful is to get ready with some screens. I have two screens on my computer. These days, because we are all in our homes, I run games only online, so it's really easy. One screen is for Roll20, one screen is for searching the pendulum for any sort of information, and my notes, which I always keep in a single document because I want them always in front of me. All of the notes, one place. I'm used to putting everything in a Keep specific, Keep note. I don't know if you use Google Keep at home, but I do. And I at first thought I would use different notes for different things, but everything went all over. So instead, everything is in a single file, a single note, and I separate between important bits by just doing a few dashes. So this bit is about what is currently happening and I really need to remember. And this bit is about things that will happen in the future because of events that transpired. All sorts of consequences I should remember. This is, of course, the way I keep note of everything, not just published adventures. But in published adventures, it is usually easier because you only need to note what is changed, what is different from what is written down. By having two screens, or a screen and a tablet, or a tablet and a book, whatever, you allow yourself some ability to flip between pages. So you can look at the NPC details in one screen and have in front of you the book with the current encounter. For me, this is the best way. And so, before every session, I make sure I know where is what. In my lap, I carry a specific book on a specific page. On my right screen, I have this and this open. On my left screen, I have this and this open. Now I'm ready. That's how I run my published adventures. I know where the specific adventure is and what I need from it. Finally, my last thing here is avoiding rule abdication as much as possible. I delegate to players. I always delegate to players rules in any case, but with published adventures, I find it really useful because all of my screens and lap is already occupied by something else. So I don't have time or the mental capability to also look for the rules. Instead, how about you guys look for the rules and tell me what's going on, and I'll say yes, sure, or no, and we'll continue.
I have two tips that I found that really helps me. And number one is that you should simply use what works for you. Mm. Now, Eran mentioned that he uses Google Keep for everything because that's what works for him. So he's also using it for running published adventures. If you have some other tool, some other method of organizing your information or your day-to-day task, use that for your adventure management as well.
Yeah, you're already used to it. You already know how it works.
Exactly. You have invested time and effort to get the XP, to become an expert in this specific tool. Use it. Use whatever works for you. Number two, there is a very simple trade-off here. You can spend a lot of time before the session making everything to your liking and organizing everything, and that would probably help you during the session. Bear in mind that you would rather spend 5 to 10 minutes organizing thing and getting all your notes settled up before the session to save even 1 minute of looking a specific rule or information during the session. 1 minute of nothing happening in a gaming session is a big hurdle for the pacing of the game. While 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour before affects no one but you. However, the obvious trade-off is that you invest this time and you might not have all this time and effort to invest. Mm. So try and reach a balance that works for you. A balance in which you say, okay, I can allow myself to have 1, 2, 30 seconds, 1 minute of quiet at my table if it would take me more than 10 minutes out of session in order to overcome that.
Finally, before we send you off to get your own amazing published adventures and run them amazingly, a few recommendations, adventures that we ourselves really like and would like to suggest to you guys. I would like to start with Into the Wilds. It's a dungeon called Classic Adventure, designed for D&D 3.5. Back in the days where they were designing adventures for 3.5. And I like it because it's super duper straightforward. There are several locations. Each of them is only like 10 or 12 rooms, I think. So it's mini dungeons. You can understand all of them. You can grok all of them, keep them in your mind quite easily. It's not like 30 rooms and then you'll never know what's in the 30 rooms, of course. But in 10 rooms, you're sort of able to envision how the players go through it, how it will feel during the session, how long it will take during the session. And that's great. It works for me very well. Beyond that, I really like Into the Wilds because it has some awesome, cool, simple, very D&D things going on. I won't get into details, but there are goblins on giant bats. I also really like Forge of Fury, which I'm currently running. It reminds me of Into the Wilds very much. It was recently translated to D&D 5 as part of Tales from the Yawning Portal. I bought it for Roll20 and I'm currently running it. And first of all, of course, D&D 5 is great fun, and dungeon adventures are great fun, but I find that Forge of Fury is also very simple to run. Again, it has several dungeons, each of them like 10-12 rooms. The interactions are straightforward. I understand what's going on, and nothing is ever too complicated. It is one of the only adventures I've ever found in my life that I feel more energized after running it rather than less. It is so much fun to run it that I find myself looking forward for more sessions where I get to relax by running Forge of Fury. How weird. The next adventure, which is another one when I felt the same sort of feeling, is Lost Mine of Phandelver. Now, this is almost a mini campaign. It takes the players from, I think, level 1 to level 5, if I remember correctly. It's part of the starter set of D&D 5th edition, and it's one of the best adventures I've ever read and ever ran. And I would, in a heartbeat, run it again to anyone. It's quite long. There are like 5, I think, locations. And some of the locations have more than dozens of encounters and many inhabitants. But again, everything is, generally speaking, straightforward. The adventure does not throw you, the GM, into any sort of confusing unknown unknowns. Everything is laid out in a way that is clear, and I like it because it really gives the players a lot to do and a lot of freedom without turning you, the GM, into this crazed mess that has to look back and forth throughout the adventure. Where, is this here? Is this there? Where are they going? What is happening? No, everything is built very cleverly. My next recommendation is The Portal Under the Stars. It's the beginning adventure that comes with Dungeon Crawl Classics, the role-playing game. It's in the last few pages of that book. I think it might be one of the adventures I ran the most times in my life because it does everything as it should. Every room has a cool thing, like a single thing. So as a GM, you don't need to read between like 10 different paragraphs to understand what is going on. It mostly describes what currently is there, and then the players just react to whatever is there, and that's where the fun comes from. So as a GM, you don't need to plan. You just need to know what's there. Really straightforward way of running things that DCC in general, the Dungeon Crawl Classic, is really in favor of. And finally, it's just not that long. I think it takes about 3 hours, and that even considering that the parties are 4 characters per player, because it's what's called a funnel adventure, in which many, many characters are going to die. And that's part of the fun. That's part of why we are playing this strange adventure. A lot happens in those 3 hours, and that's, I think, one of the reasons I really like it. You always go out of it with feeling, oh, wow, I would love to play some more of this. My last recommendation is a series of adventures, Parnest series for D&D 5. The whole arc of Adventure League adventures from the Storm King Thunders series. I think there are about 15 of them. I ran all of them, and they are a lot of fun. Some of them obviously more than others, and as a series they combine into a little campaign about what is happening in the small town of Parnast. You can run some of them completely on their own. I highly recommend checking out Giant Diplomacy, Uninvited Guests, Beneath the Fetid Chalimber, but many others are a lot of fun. Each of them are supposed to take about 2 hours. So they are short, simple adventures, very easy to run. Even the ones that are more complicated, like Giant Diplomacy, where there is a lot of diplomacy with giants. And even the one that's the most complicated, Parnast Under Siege, which can be run with 3 different parties all at the same time. And it's a siege with a whole army attacking Parnast. It's an amazing, it's so much fun. Again, not all that complicated because they created simple subsystems that you can use during the game. And that's it. Those are my recommendations.
I have 3 adventures to recommend. One of them is an old DCC Dungeon Crawl classic, excellent, called Palace in the Wastes, which is load of fun if you're into Dungeon Crawl classics. It's a few levels of awesome fun where you just afraid to die all the time, but you get a very, very ingrained sense of story and history as you progress throughout the module. Number 2 is actually a series of adventures, City of the Spider Queen. It's almost a campaign, D&D version 3.5. It starts with level 10 and goes all the way to 18. And I think it's one of the best adventures I've encountered story-wise. Everything leads to the next phase of the story in a really, really tied together way, which I really liked. And thirdly, it's your adventure run from Crystal Heart, Exotic Ingredients, which I've participated in, that I participated in a playtest of, and then bought it, and then read it, and it is excellently done and loads of fun. Major emphasis on fun.
I actually didn't know that you bought it and read it. Good, because as a player, you should know this, as a player, you're in no position to recommend a published module. You are consuming a processed product. I think that so much of the module is dependent on how fun and useful it is for the GM to read it.
Since I played it, I'm not going to play it again. I bought it specifically to run it to other people. I have read it as a GM thinking of running it. I have bought it after I played it. So I am jaded.
Therefore, in summary, in short.
In summary, you might love running published adventures. You might dislike them. But I will say this, as someone who does not usually enjoy running published adventures. Published adventures, the good ones among them, are an excellent asset and resource to teach you a lot about how to create and craft your own adventures. Even if you're not planning on running a specific adventure, a specific published adventure, just the act of reading it, understanding how it's constructed, why is it segmented, how the story flows from one scene to the next and from one segment to the next, would help you a lot in creating and processing your own stories as you create them.
Uri, I suggest we do something else instead of taking the load off this time. And not only because this is episode 99, which is strange and unusual. Also because we've been talking a lot about published adventures, but actually, both you and I have several published adventures. And you just mentioned, I think, one of the most important things about them, except for being fun and easy to run, they teach you new stuff. So, in order to give some legitimacy to our own adventures, how about we present what we think is the thing that GMs can learn, and therefore players maybe be able to learn through them, from our adventures, and why each of them is recommended, therefore. Not for the experience that it offers, but for what can be learned from it.
Interesting. Let's go.
Then I'll start with my 2 adventures. The first one is called One Last Tribute, and it's a dungeon adventure. And I think that the thing I like most about it is how every combat scene is dynamic. I made sure to include some sort of unusual element in every encounter. So instead of there are 3 goblins here, something will happen. Either because one of the goblins will try to run away, or because maybe the room will shift, or because I just don't want to spoil anything, so I'm inventing stuff on the spot. In the adventure itself, every encounter has something going on, and I think that at least two of them will be very memorable, stuff that you will talk about later on, about how I did X and how you did Y, and then that interesting thing happened. And I think that One Last Tribute is really good with presenting such encounters, such situations. My second adventure is called Shed Not a Tear, O Princess, and I think it's pretty good with creating certain atmosphere. It's a sad adventure about a tragic happening, and by the end of it, let's say it like this, not much remains, and it is hopefully sad and maybe a bit touching for the players. I won't say that they will be crying by the end of it, they certainly won't be. It's still a very much D&D adventure, and there are some fights, and in the end, you had an experience, but it wasn't, I think, an actually dramatic experience. But you had an experience, and I think that the adventures created that atmosphere by doing several, I hope, clever tricks. At least one of them is pointing the players forward down a road that seems very likely at the moment, but is actually inevitable in hindsight. And I won't get into details on how this happens, but it's all about pacing, I think. So I suggest that if you read through the adventure, try to imagine how things just flow from a moment to the other, and see that despite it being designed around three encounters, I would say that in many ways it's a single thing that just begins and then ends. What about you?
Well, the first adventure I published, Escaping Thelemus Lab, is built around one interesting idea, which is, okay, if we start the adventure at the end and work our way back, what would happen? There's an interesting concept in which you start an adventure with your character in an unknown location and you have no idea what happened. And you try to piece together what led you to this point in time. I wanted to create something like that, but one that would make sense and not feel forced. And I tried doing that by having the adventure start after you achieve your goal, and then you need to somehow backtrack your way out. And I think I did a pretty good job with it from the reviews I got from people saying, oh, it was really interesting to do a dungeon crawl, but in reverse. A dungeon flying? A dungeon floating? A dungeon... I don't know. My other adventure, Rolling with Laughter, is something that I wanted to publish for, I think, 10 years now, ever since that adventure won the Israeli Olympic GMing contest. For me, running comedy games has always been my staple. I have always managed to get my players to laugh. And it took me a long while to understand that for other people, comedy might be really hard at the gaming table. And even when it actually happens, it's usually either out-of-game jokes or jokes that are based on the fact that we, the players, are looking at our characters and what they are doing. The humor is not inherent in the game. The game is not supposed to be comedic, but the way we do things make it seem humorous. And I wanted to do something different. I wanted to have a game whose purpose is to be funny, but I also wanted it to be a guide to explain to new GMs or veteran GMs who are not good with comedy how to make the funny. And as we all know, nothing is more funny than when you explain every single joke.
Sure.
But that's exactly what this adventure is. Right. It's a set of encounters with jokes inside each and every one of them, and the jokes are explained so you can run it and let the comedy reveal itself. The jokes are actually inherently part of the plot and of the NPCs and of the characters themselves, but without being removed from the agency of the players. The board is set up, so to speak, that the players will perform actions which are funny and will interact with things in a humorous manner without any of it feeling forced. And so far, it seems it's working from the emails I get. So I'm really happy about that, especially now that both of my adventures are free to download for as long as we stay in social distancing. And I think people might really need the comedy.
Excellent. Everyone, if you want to recommend to us adventures that you like, and I am always looking for recommendations, always, always, as long as they come with some explanation of what is the reason for the recommendation, email us at show@dwarfcast.net. I'm especially interested in hearing about adventures that are not for D&D 5, stuff that are out there in the world, and I would love to buy some adventures if the money goes to the hand of good writers, good editors, etc. If you want to send us a question, again, show@dwarfcast.net, and you can find us throughout the internet. Just search for On the Shot of Dwarves. That's it. Our next episode is 100. We would love to see you there, but we won't be able to because this is a podcast. So the most that can be done is you can listen to us, and we will never be able to see you. That's just how things are. But until then...
Later. Shoulders of Dwarves is shared under Creative Commons by attribution non-commercial 4. Intro and outro are by The Cliché Dio, and you can email us at show@dwarfcast.net.
On the shoulders of dwarves.